Thanks for coming along, everyone. My name's Shane Morris. I'm a UX guy, user experience guy. I've been a user interface designer, usability guy, user experience guy for a long time. Worked for Microsoft for a while as a user experience evangelist. My job today is to introduce us to the design language around the new user interfaces in Windows 8 and in Windows Phone. I've actually got two sessions. Today we're sort of going to talk more about the philosophy and inspirations behind the new UIs. And I want to do that not just because it's interesting, but because I think if you guys are thinking about designing user experiences for Windows 8 or for Windows Phone, it's really useful to start by thinking about what the guiding principles are and derive your user experience and your user interface from that, rather than sort of starting with fonts and layouts and grids and stuff like that. When we think about the new user interface, we tend to think about those things, the colored squares and the Sego font and the specific layout and the animations, and all those things are important. But at the end of the day, those are the expressions of your awesome user experience. The job of the pixels at the end of the day is to communicate to our users all the good work you've done designing and experience designing a service that works for them. So today it's a bit about the principles and some of those things to bear in mind. We'll talk a little bit about some of the, sort of the challenges and sort of interesting aspects of the new UIs. Tomorrow morning, if you're up early enough at 8 o'clock, we'll dive in a little deeper and we'll talk more about the rules and regulations. We'll talk about the fonts and the widgets and the grid and the spacings and the layouts and stuff like that. So it's a two-part talk. Today we'll get the big picture and the philosophy behind the new user interfaces. Tomorrow we'll talk more about widgets and the rules. So a little bit about me. As I said, I'm a user interface designer. I run a small design consultancy called Automatic Studio, and we basically consult and mentor and train in user experience design. We work for a bunch of companies around Australia. And we don't exclusively work with Microsoft stuff, but we do a lot of work on the Microsoft platform. Here are some of the Windows Phone applications we've worked on. The Qantas app 2 weeks ago was awarded best application on Windows Phone in the Australian Mobile Awards, so we're pretty proud of that. We've also been doing some Windows 8 work, most of which I can't show you yet because it's sort of all queued up for the launch date. We're working with on three projects that will be available on launch. So I'm going to show you a couple of projects that I only had a little bit to do with, SBS and TV Fix. So I worked with Alex, who's over there somewhere, on the initial sort of information architecture and interaction model for the SBS app, but all the credit for the actual visuals and the rendering go to Alex and Jordan at Xamling who did the work. The TV Fix app, similarly, I'm not taking credit for the entire user interface, but I sort of got involved in some specific elements of the UI for TV Fix. As I said, unfortunately, I can't tell you specifically about some of the other work we're doing, but I will sort of try and pull out some stories from that work without naming names. So that's me and us. We need to address the elephant in the room. When Microsoft introduced Windows Phone UI a while ago, they introduced this term Metro, which was the internal code name for the new design language. And it kind of took on a bit of a life of its own, this Metro term. And things were supposed to be called, you know, codename Metro, but things just became called Metro, not just by us in the sort of in the ecosystem, but also by Microsoft folks. But officially, we're not supposed to call it Metro. We're supposed to call it the new user interface, or the Windows 8 user interface, or the Windows Phone user interface. I'll try and stick to those rules, but I might mention Metro by name from time to time, either because it's just what I'm used to, or because this is only a one-hour session and I don't have time to say the Windows user interface, Windows 8 user interface, and the Windows Phone user interface every time. So every time, apart from this slide, that I mention Metro, well, that the Metro is on a slide, I've got a prize for the first person who spots it. Okay. So most of you have seen the Windows 8 UI, but I want to take us on a little bit of a tour. I just sort of want to point out some of the things that I think are interesting from a user interface design point of view. So as you know, Windows 8 starts with the start screen. The screen that I call the Asian supermarket screen. Because everything's trying to yell at you and you don't know where to look. But we're starting to see the visual language here. So we see a lot of use of empty space, of what we call white space. We see the start of the typography. We'll see more of that as we drill in, and we see this tile-based user interface, these square tiles of solid color. We see this thing called semantic zoom. This idea that when we zoom out. We can get a bigger picture of the content we're looking at, which isn't necessarily just an optical zoom. We can change the actual presentation style when we zoom out. I guess one of the things to note about any Windows 8 user interface is that there's not a lot of what we call Chrome. Sorry, Alex. Let's try something else. There's not a lot of what we call Chrome, so controls, widgets, buttons, checkboxes, drop-down menus, menu bars, toolbars, the things that made up the vocabulary of the desktop GUI languages are missing. And instead, what we do is we focus on content. We focus on the information that people need to process or consume. And with the assumption that if we present that information well enough, that can form the user interface. And we'll talk about that in a little while. A couple of other things to note about... Rihanna's got a new tattoo. Other things to notice about particularly Windows 8 is because of those lack of controls on screen, we have these sort of... Let's call them hidden user interface elements that we're relying on users to learn to look for in the charms and in the app bars. So by not having controls in the screen, by avoiding buttons and checkboxes and stuff in the actual screens, what Microsoft wants us to do is instead move those controls out into typically two places, into the app bar. Let's go back to the home screen. So the app bar along the bottom has buttons that relate to the current screen. We have more freedom for what we want to use the app bar at the top for, but typically it's supposed to be for navigation, for navigating around the app. What's interesting about that is that we lose the opportunity to associate controls with content, which is actually a key principle of traditional desktop graphical user interfaces. By placing a button or a control near the content, we create an association in people's minds. So it's quite interesting that Microsoft has sort of moved away from what's sort of a standard tool in the user interface designer's toolkit by separating the content from the controls that operate on it. And of course, we have these charms out the side, which from a user interface design point of view, I guess what's interesting about them is that there's a trade-off here. By having a consistent user interface and a consistent place for people to look for those standard features, search and share and settings, our users don't have to learn a new user interface on every application. They don't need to learn for each application where to find search or where or whether they can share. All those things are in a consistent place. The price we pay, of course, is that discoverability thing, and it takes a moment. In fact, in my informal testing, it can take more than a moment, but 5 minutes is the worst I've had in my testing with just friends before someone finds that they usually discover this swipe first by accident, the swipe off the top to open the app bar. And then once they find that, they start swiping in other places and they find the other stuff. And if you've installed Windows 8, while you're waiting for the installation, Microsoft plays you a little video that teaches you those basic gestures. I think I've covered the main elements of the user interface. Oh, well, obviously panoramic, seamless panoramas are an important part of the UI. Whoops. And what's really interesting to me about that from a user interface point of view is that it's leveraging our spatial memory, our here in the real world, when we process the visual field, our brain is selectively attending to what's sort of immediately in front of us or whatever we've decided to give our attention. But it's also not just processing what's in the periphery, but remembering where things are relative to each other in the periphery. And what's really interesting about panoramas to me is that, unlike a traditional carousel that we saw where you sort of flip through, you might slide elements in, like on iPhone, you might slide pages in, but each page is a distinct page and sort of snaps into place. What's interesting about this panorama is, firstly, it's a bit sort of just fun and a bit more rewarding to muck around in, but it seems to better leverage that that idea of a seamless visual field. The other interesting thing, I guess, about the new user interface, almost, is the use of animation, which is actually more interesting on the phone. If you've mucked around with a Windows phone, those guys have done a really interesting and amazing job with how they've used animation purposefully. Most of the animation on Windows Phone is there for a reason, to help the user understand where they are in the stack of applications or where they are within one application. Windows 8 uses animation as well, particularly for transitions to show you that some information has arrived or disappeared or that this information has changed. But interestingly, the phone probably makes better use of animation, I think, than Windows 8 itself. And that's probably for a good reason, right? Because when you're looking at a user interface on the phone, we've got far fewer pixels to play with, and so there's less opportunity for us to provide that orientation information, that information that helps the user situate themselves inside our application. Where am I? Where have I been? Where can I go next? And so the phone team sort of have compensated for that by using the medium of animation to help us create that orientation in our head to build what we call a mental model of how the application fits together. With more pixels on a tablet, or even more pixels on Windows 8 running on a desktop, perhaps that's why they haven't felt the need to put as much work into the animation. I'm not saying the animation is bad on Windows 8. I think probably what I'm saying is that the animation is remarkably good on the phone. So anyway, that was the quick tour. I don't think I've missed any of the main points. Having said that, what I want to do is sort of talk a little bit about the history of this design language, according to Microsoft, talk a little bit about the philosophy behind it and how it can help us do our design. So, I guess it's worth saying that when the phone UI was first introduced in beta, my reaction was a little bit skeptical. In fact, this was my reaction. Well, it wasn't actually my reaction. That's a reconstruction of my reaction in the hotel room the other night. But I was a little bit perplexed. In fact, I was speaking to Dave Glover before the phone was officially released and saying, I'm really excited to see what the real UI is going to look like. And because I assumed all these big colored rectangles and squares were placeholders for the real user interface. He had to assure me that was the real user interface. So some of the things that were on my mind was, firstly, the controls. When you do see them, the buttons and the sliders and the text boxes and something, are completely unadorned and pretty ugly, if you ask me. So that surprised me. Particularly on the phone, we also saw some rather odd screen layouts, because pretty much everything's text-based and everything is left aligned. You come across some screens that look like they're going to fall over sideways, because everything is aligned to the left and there's empty space on the right, which, what I know about design, that's something that we try to avoid. We try to create screens that seem to be balanced in visual weight, just because people are more comfortable with an idea of something that's more symmetrical. So that surprised me. This lack of affordance is the fancy term for the properties of an object that tell us how to use it and what to do with it. Because Metro. Anyone? There you go. Because Metro has stripped away the things that we had in traditional GUIs, like in a scroll bar on a traditional Windows GUI, there's those little notches on the thing, which is supposed to suggest to us that if it was a real thing, we'd put our thumb there and we'd scroll it up and down. Stripping out those affordances, for me as an old school usability guy, was a bit confronting, because we'd relied, in the early days of graphical user interfaces, we'd relied on those 3D edges and the things that looked like real world objects and controls to help users bring their knowledge of the real world to the computer. So for me, like, it's because I was old school, that was kind of confronting. I thought a lot of the screens were very bland, because the premise is in the new UI is that if we just show the information you need to see in its most minimal form, then we're communicating the most effectively. And that's true, but the price you pay for that is, particularly on the phone, you'll find a lot of screens that you look at and think, wow, that's just really not interesting. Fortunately, most of those screens are really not interesting screens, like setting screens and stuff like that. But some of the apps have just come across a little bit bland. I guess the other thing that was interesting to me as a user interface designer is that it's pretty much optimized for content consumption. The design language that they've given us is all about apps where people are consuming content, videos, text, news, mail, Twitter, games, whatever it is. They've given us very little to work with for content creation, for applications where users need to actually input a lot of information. There is, in fact, a bunch of guidance about that, but the design language is clearly optimized for consumption scenarios. And I guess the next thing you worry about as a designer is that there doesn't seem to be a very rich palette for us to work with. Text in three font sizes, only one font, fixed grid alignments, fixed spacing between elements, solid blocks of saturated color, just doesn't seem like much of a palette to work with. And so, these are all the things that worried me when I sort of first got introduced to the phone user interface. But there were some intriguing things as well. This is me being intrigued. It probably explains a lot about my dating history. Some of the things that I just said were also intriguing in terms of what they say about where we're going in terms of design. This lack of Chrome, the controls and the orientation and all the stuff that's not content that we'd see on a traditional application and even on a traditional website is an interesting idea. It says I'll talk about this more in a sec, but it says something about where we're going in terms of user interface design, or where our users are going in terms of their confidence and sophistication in using digital products. The lack of affordance for a similar reason. I've already sort of talked about the panoramas. I think the panoramas, both on the phone and on Windows 8, officially on Windows 8 they're called hubs, are a really interesting idea and a really interesting leverage, as I said, of how we process information normally. The other interesting thing, I didn't really talk about live tiles, but the interesting implication of live tiles is that we now design applications that are not just open or closed, but they're also a little bit open, and a little bit more open, and a little bit more open. If you think about Windows 8, your application starts with a live tile, which may just have an icon or may be previewing some of the information inside the application. A user might decide that they like your application so much that they'll opt in for the wide tile, and we get to show them a little bit more information. At the next level of openness, they might snap. We didn't talk about snap. And I don't know if PowerPoint plays well with snap there. They might snap your application to the side. So we've been given a slightly bigger window in which to present information, but we still don't have a lot of opportunity for interactivity. It's still very much content consumption. And then we get a full screen experience, and for some apps they go even beyond that and they might have a desktop experience as well. So a good example of that is OneNote, right? We have OneNote MX, which is the Metro style. Someone can come and get that later. Yeah, the Metro style user interface for OneNote, but we also have OneNote on the desktop, which it provides a richer user interface using the traditional metaphors of the desktop. And it's worth saying, in case I don't get to it later, the desktop UI and the ribbon and all the elements that make up the traditional Windows user interface design language are not dead, in my opinion, at all. It's really about finding the level between this content consumption and content creation. And if you're creating an app where there's a lot of information going in, where there's as much or more information going in as there is coming out, then you really want to think about whether maybe your app is a traditional desktop app, because that's where we have all those devices that we can use for productivity applications, the ribbons and the toolboxes and the task panels and the modal dialogues and all that sort of stuff that we don't necessarily have in the Metro environment. So this degrees of openness, that's probably all I'm going to have time to say about it, but is an intriguing element. And then, of course, this idea of animation as a first-class citizen in the design language. And traditionally, in GUIs, animation really wasn't something that we had available to us, firstly because of performance reasons, and secondly because the tools that we design and build user interfaces in didn't really provide us the power to create effective animations, and which has as much as anything to do with the process of designing animations, which is a bit iterative. But on the phone and on Windows 8, animation is now one of the first class tools that we have in our vocabulary, to mix my metaphors, to do design with. So it's worth putting this new UI design language or these languages in context. And these are some slides from Microsoft. You might have seen them before. But you can sort of trace the evolution of the new UI back through the history of content-focused applications from Microsoft. Some would argue it goes all the way back to Expedia, which we're talking back in 1995, before some of you were born, I suspect. So even way back then, this application stood out from a traditional Windows GUI of the time, because the controls were flattened away and that Chrome was sort of de-emphasized in favor of content for perfectly good reason. Expedia was all about, it was a CD-ROM encyclopedia. Expedia was all about content consumption. So it's natural that we would draw attention to the content and away from the controls. It really came into it with Media Center, where we started to see much more use of animation, sort of the germs of the panorama with the horizontal scrolling of the menu in Media Center, use of animation, as I said, and much more focus on text as a way to communicate information. Back in the olden days, we were sort of obsessed with iconography. We thought that icons, toolbar icons and button icons were the secret to creating great user interface. What we'd learnt, particularly with applications like Office, once Word had 600 features or whatever it's got these days, is that there is not an icon for every one of 600 features. In fact, university tests show us that you pretty much can't expect people to tell you the meaning of an icon. You pretty much can't expect them to do that. Apart from a few icons they've seen before, like the floppy disk for save and those sorts of things, and apart from a few other sort of relatively obvious icons, if you go about designing icons for your application with the intention that the first time a person ever sees it, they'll know what you mean, you're wasting your time. The best you can hope for is recognizable icons, icons that people, when they see it the second time, say, oh, yes, I remember, that's the icon for new Slide Master or something. All by which is saying, there's nothing wrong with text, there's nothing wrong with words. As a more succinct and effective way to communicate what it is you want to say. They say a picture tells 1,000 words, right? But you'll notice we don't talk in pictures. We can communicate more effectively with words, and I guess applications like Media Center, and they're not the only one, of course, started to acknowledge that and started to say, well, maybe we don't need to dress our application with icons. Zune is part of this tradition as well. I should say that I think Zune is one of the best user interfaces that has ever come out of Microsoft. The products were pretty good too, but the user interface is awesome. Because it's so rich, it's trying to do so much, and yet it is still sort of gets away with this sort of more minimalist, more browsy sort of experience. So all of these things are part of the journey to the new user interfaces. Firstly, we saw with the phone. We're also seeing it on Xbox, of course, and what we're mainly talking about today is Windows 8. So the reason you can start to see why the products like Windows 8 are stripped back, have less affordance, less Chrome. It's to allow the content to come to the fore. The problem then is, if the content is the user interface, if all our pixels are taken up with expressing content, then the content has to do more work than it ever did before. It can't just communicate information. It also has to be the user interface itself. It has to communicate the information structure, it has to communicate the navigation, and it also has to be interactive. It has to provide ways for users to actually do stuff, be productive. So our content has to work a lot harder. The principles behind Metro sort of help us to understand how to do that. But just by way of summary, I sort of teased out some of the more interesting characteristics of Metro into visual interaction and information design elements. We tend to think about the new user interface from a visual point of view. It's about the Sego font, it's about the spacing, it's about the coloured tiles. But as much as anything, it's about the way we want people to interact with our products, which is why I've got a column there for interaction design, and it's also about the way we're going to organise information. And things like the live tiles and the gradual revealing of information and content, things like semantic zoom are built into the platform as ways to express information design rather than to be aesthetic, for example, or rather than to be ways for users to affect actions so much as understand where they are in the application. So I was going to talk about the principles. So these are the five principles of the design language according to Microsoft. Pride in craftsmanship, fast and fluid, authentically digital, and do more with less. So this is where I got that term from the talk title about being authentically digital. When I first read that term, being someone who works in the design industry, I immediately recognised that as a piece of designer wank. But I came to understand. When people say, what do you mean by authentically digital, the immediate response is, well, that means ugly widgets, because our widgets don't, if we're being authentically digital, in other words, we're not trying to decorate or refer to the real world, we're just trying to use the minimal number of pixels that we need to express the purpose of our control. Now, I'm starting to sound like one of those designers. Then our controls only need to be as minimal and ugly as this. This is part of what they mean by authentically digital, but it's more than that, and we'll come back to that in a little while. But in fact, now. Let me do up the shoelace. You're all waiting for me to trip over, I know. Basically, what Microsoft is hinting at is that we've come to a point where a digital product no longer needs to refer to the real world. Remember those sort of metaphors like the scroll bars and the push buttons and stuff, in order for people to get how to use it. And so this idea that today's users are much more confident to just tap stuff. I think that's the next point, right? People will just tap. So once again, back when we first designed graphical user interfaces, we had to design into the user interface a lot of stuff. We had to use a lot of pixels to reassure people that they, or to allow people to know what would happen when they press something. Because people were scared of computers. People, whenever we did usability testing of these early applications, whenever something went wrong, our test subjects always blamed themselves. Oh, it's me. I'm sure someone who was more comfortable or more used to computers wouldn't have this problem. I'm so silly. If you test with users today, you don't get that anymore. There's been a complete change in people's attitudes and relationship to the technology they use. So now when they do something and it turns out that they did the wrong thing or something goes wrong, it's no longer the user's fault. It's clearly the service provider's fault, as it should be, as it always was, in fact. What I'm saying is that our users are much more confident to just poke and play and prod and stretch and zoom and spin and do whatever they want with the application because they expect us to protect them from being stupid, which is very different, as I said, to where we started. What that means is the gift we get from that is that we don't have to spend so many of our precious pixels reassuring people that it'll be okay or pre-communicating to them what will happen if you do this thing. And there's one of the applications we're working on at the moment has a really interesting use of drag and drop to do something that people wouldn't know. You would think, and when I first saw it, when the client sort of proposed this idea, I'm like, really? You think people will do that and they'll feel okay about that? And they've done a bunch of testing. Turns out it is. Sorry, I can't tell you what it is. Even when we sent it off to Microsoft for review, they came back saying, really? You think that that's going to be okay, that people will get what the intention is there? Fortunately, the testing tells us that it'll be all right. But the point is that today's users will just drag stuff and try stuff out. And that gives us permission to just focus on the content. And so, you know, to unpack this idea of authentically digital, the suggestion is that just expressing information and services and behavior in its purely digital form is enough. I'll come back to that. If that sounds a bit vague, I'll come back to it a bit more when we talk a little bit more about the inspiration behind the new UI, which we're about to do. So Microsoft points to sort of one inspiration and three influences, or is it the other way around? We'll look at each of them separately. They talk about wayfinding signage in sort of, particularly in public transport, and they talk about two design schools, the International Typographic School, which we'll talk about in a sec, and the Bauhaus. And they also refer to motion design, particularly from cinematography, and we'll look at that as well. So Microsoft tells us that this is in fact where the name of the code name of the product came from signage in stations and airports. And when you think about it, this makes perfect sense. If you're designing the signage for an airport, say, your job is to communicate the minimal amount of information in the most succinct and efficient way to get people moving around the airport to where they need to be. Because otherwise, you start to have traffic flow problems. And there's actually a whole field of study around wayfinding and how to design buildings and spaces to communicate to people how they should and can move around in them. So it's not at all surprising that when you look at the UI and you compare it to the sorts of signage that you even see around the convention center, there's a natural relationship here, and it's all about stripping away any unnecessary visual information so that people can focus on exactly and find exactly what it is they're looking for. If we go back in history, Microsoft tells us they drew inspiration from three schools of design. The first is the Swiss school, or the International Typography School. So back in the 30s-ish, through to 60s and even into the 70s, the Swiss school was all about information is beautiful. And that when you look at posters like this one, the premise behind the design of this poster is if we present the information in its most natural way and we express the relationship and the how that information is naturally structured, then not only we are communicating well, but that is aesthetically pleasing in some way because it's satisfying to us as consumers that we understand the structure, So even if you're not a German speaker, you can probably pretty much work out the structure and purpose of this poster just by the way relative sizes of type have been used, the way different types of grouping and particular white space have been used, and the way alignment has been used. And what's interesting about even a static poster like this is the different ways you can read it across and down, and the ways you immediately interpret the different font sizes and weights to indicate what we call a visual hierarchy. What's really interesting about the Swiss school is that the argument was that the natural design for any information can be found inside the information, and it doesn't need to be decorated. And this was a big deal back in the 30s and 40s, because before that, if you look at advertising, for example, it was highly decorated. There were 7 fonts on the page, and there was illustrations of happy housewives and stuff like that. Come the Swiss school, advertising stripped out a lot of that decoration and just got to the point. So it's very relevant to what we're trying to do with these new user interfaces, where we just want to express the information in its most natural way. And what's really interesting about it is it says there it was meant to be rational. So it wasn't about subjective, I think this looks better than that. The idea was that if you studied the content, the information closely enough, it would reveal to you how to design the poster. And Metro... we have the same intention at Microsoft, that the key to the design of your page or your screen or the structure of your application is there for you in the natural structure of the information. So if any of you know a bit about the Bauhaus school, you can see that there's some obvious parallels here. So the Bauhaus was a design school focusing more on industrial design and later architecture in Germany around about the same time, 30s, late 20s. Didn't last as long, wasn't as popular as the Swiss school. But what was going on with the Bauhaus school was that they had this catchphrase that you've all heard before, form follows function, which is by way of saying the natural design of a chair or a house or whatever is determined by what it's meant to do. So if you design to meet the purpose, if you design the chair to meet the purpose of sitting, you've created the minimal, most effective design. Agile developers in the room that term will sound familiar, right? Bauhaus was a response to two things: the introduction of mass production, the fact that, and therefore a move away from artisanship. Mass production allowed us to produce dozens and dozens and dozens of steel chairs made of steel tubing, hundreds and thousands of them. But the only way to do that was to strip away the beautiful carved legs and all the sort of adornment of a traditional chair. And it was a response. So Bauhaus was a response to the more decorative design movements before it, Art Nouveau and Art Deco, which had decorative elements for the sake of decoration. So love it or hate it, there's an interesting parallel between Bauhaus's response to Art Nouveau and Art Deco and Microsoft's UI response to where user interfaces had been going. We'll come back to this in a sec in terms of the amount of shiny pixels and beautiful glossy buttons and sort of all that sort of decoration that is another direction where user interfaces have been going lately. So that was, don't worry, the design lesson stopped soon. The third place that they took inspiration from, they tell us, is from motion design, which is a really interesting design field because it really only... Did I say Metro? All right. Who was that? I'll Metro go and... No. nice one. Motion design is a quintessentially modern design field because until we got our grips around animation in cinematography, motion design was limited to rotoscopes that you span around in the Victorian era. It's an entirely new design field, and for us as user interface designers, it's quite new. I'll come back to that as well. Did I queue up the video or did I forget to? Dang. Let's just see if we can quickly pull it up. So this the title sequence from North by Northwest after the ad. So this title sequence designed by Saul Bass, a very famous sort of mid-century designer, did a lot of the famous title sequences from this era that you're probably familiar with, and inspired pretty much all title design since then. Using what we call kinetic type, moving type around to create, to not just orientate people in the information, to help people understand the hierarchy of information, but also to start to create an emotional response, which was really interesting. And this idea that we could just move words around and the nature of their movement would actually engender an emotional response was a fairly new idea, hot on the heels of Disney working out that we could do that with animated characters. So that inspiration... that motion design is the fourth inspiration. There's a common thread here, particularly with the first three, and that's about information first. And you've picked up the theme, right, in the last few slides. The idea that the design of our application will be informed by the nature of the information that we have to present first and foremost. So this is what I wanted to emphasize with you guys, that when you sit down to start designing your phone or your Windows 8 application, because the design language is so distinct, there's a tendency to start thinking about fonts and white space and colored blocks and live tiles and grids and all the elements that make up the on-screen persona of the design language. But even the Microsoft guys say that the design languages are inspired by a set of principles and then rendered individually onto each of the platforms, but there's a common set of principles and inspirations behind it. As I said, particularly those first three, but even the motion design stuff works because it expresses the relationship or the structure of the information. What's really interesting to me about this is all about rationalism. This is all about design derived through a rational series of steps, starting with the information, thinking about how the logical ways to interact with that information, the logical sequences that users need to move through that information, and then finally worrying about the visual design, how you're going to express that on screen. The really good news for those of us who are sort of new to the idea of user interface design is that it's largely rational. And that's the beauty, I think, of this approach, is that because it's not so reliant on aesthetic decoration, it's easier for all of us to approach to design. You would argue that the price we pay for that is that limited expressiveness, right? So a lot of sort of professional designers who are very comfortable, you know, decorating a page to produce a particular effect can find Metro frustrating because they don't have as much flexibility. Who was first? You can all fight over these later. I don't have time to... where was I? The information comes first. It's a rational approach. And so if you're not as confident as a designer, take comfort in that. And I think Microsoft did that a little bit deliberately. I think Microsoft acknowledged that they've got a strong ecosystem of developers, not as strong an ecosystem of designers. Don't listen. Put it this way, if there isn't as strong an ecosystem of designers in the Microsoft platform here in Australia, that's my fault because that was my job when I was at Microsoft. So more approachable is my summary to that. We need to move on. So just as Microsoft derived the design language from influences through principles to the actual on-screen vocabulary, when you're approaching your app, you should take a similar approach, and I've said this before at TechEd. Ask yourself first what the intention of your app is, what's the proposition. Understand the intrinsic structure of the information and also the intrinsic structure of the task that users are trying to achieve, the steps and sequence and natural paths. And then use that to derive the design rather than trying to start with placing things on the screen. Saying the same thing again. Swiss design tells us that information is beautiful unto itself. Information doesn't need to be decorated. Our Bauhaus friends tell us that we'll work out the form of our design by first understanding the function that we're trying to achieve. And our motion design friends tell us that we can tie all that together with appropriate use of animation to help users understand the relationship between the various elements on our page or our screen. So this is really important. This is the main thing I wanted to get across to you guys today, is that you don't start with the pixels. A couple more things that we can quickly talk about, though. So I mentioned authentically digital. There's four other principles that we can quickly cover. The first one is pride in craftsmanship. So these are the bullet points as provided to us by Microsoft. The real point here is that there's nowhere to hide. The price you pay for such a minimalist design language is that any one element that you place on the page gets much more attention. And so it is easier, I predict it will be easier for people to detect when something is a little bit off. So much so, I've just recently been through a design review with the folks at Seattle for one of our applications, and they literally sent me back screenshots with overlaid grids saying, and the subtitle there is 2 pixels too high. If we're going through sort of, the Uber level of design critique, you won't get that level of feedback when you try to submit your app to the store. But the point here is that it's by sweating the details, by making something that maybe is less functionally rich but is perfectly executed for the functions that it provides, that will provide a great experience with these new user interfaces. And so that means thinking about the animation, as challenging as that sometimes is, and making sure you're following all the rules, making it safe and reliable. This comes back to this point that because we're spending less time communicating to people what will happen when you poke and prod our user interface, we need to make people feel safe from the outset. And that's about, there's also a bunch of different ways to do that, but the summary of that is you need to be professional. You need to look professional. We draw so many conclusions from first impressions when we first meet a person, but also when we first meet a user interface. And so looking consistent, looking neat and tidy, using appropriate language, using consistent language, these are all the things that we should be doing to appear professional and to allow our users to feel safe to play and poke and prod and experiment with our user interface. I summarise that by look like you belong. I should say that we're not talking about games when we say this sort of stuff, because games are quite a different entity. They need to have their own personality, much more so than the vast majority of apps that are sort of more day-to-day apps that people are consuming for other than gaming reasons. The second one is fast and fluid, which, they dump a whole bunch of bullet points in here, but it's really about using animation appropriately. And I guess the one tip that I'd provide here is, so I've now been talking about how animation is a first-class citizen. Please don't take that as permission to go crazy with your animations. The other term that they use is, your animation should be purposeful. So don't animate to decorate, animate to communicate something relevant. And animation is a very powerful tool. I've talked about this before here at TechEd. Our eyes are wired to detect motion, particularly, and particularly in our peripheral vision. Anyone care to speculate why? Predators. Whoever that was. Predator guy. So our brains are wired to detect the tigers in the undergrowth. And the way they do that is by detecting movement in our peripheral vision. So animation is a really powerful tool for us as designers, which we must use carefully and use purposefully. Think about when it's appropriate to direct people's attention with motion and when it's appropriate to just stay still because people are concentrating on some information, for example. Coming back to authentically digital, and sort of to restate the idea behind authentically digital, it is that this idea that we don't need to be anything more than a digital product. We don't need to pretend to be anything else or to refer to the real world. Microsoft also jams in cloud connected as part of authentically digital, whatever. I mean, it's important, but this is a user interface design talk. We use bold colours because pixels are, bright squares of bright colour. The point of the illustration here is to say this is not authentically digital. Not saying it's bad, but the icons like the ones on the right that are decorated to be aesthetically pleasing are perfectly valid as a design direction. It's just not the design direction that that we're focusing on with these new user interfaces. Another interesting... sorry, I forgot about this slide. So this is the calendar from the iPad, which you might recognise, and provides a lot of visual richness. There's little, torn paper and staples and that sort of, I don't know if it's meant to be leather or some sort of stippled texture there on the bar at the top. It's one direction. So you might argue that, Metro is possibly a response to that, that maybe it's even talking about, well, what comes, you guys aren't listening to the content at all, you're just waiting. I'm not here to say that one is good and one is bad. I think that they both have their merits. I think the advantage of what we call, the big term for the stuff up the top is what we call skeuomorphism. You can look that up later. What skeuomorphism gives us is a particular emotional response, and that's what Apple's going for in the design of a lot of these applications. By referring back to some old school stuff, paper staples and stuff like that, they're trying to engender a particular emotional response. That's really interesting because that's one of the hardest things to do, I think, with these new applications. If you're going for, if you're trying to engender a particular emotional reaction with the particular palette we've been given, that's not so easy and possibly requires a lot of design thought. What I thought was the next slide was this semantic zoom thing, which is another interesting expression of this authentically digital idea. This idea that when we zoom out, we don't need to do an optical zoom like in the real world, like flying up above the information. We can refactor the information, format the information differently to suit that different scale. And that's this idea of a semantic zoom. It's an entirely digital idea because there is no analogy for that in the real world. It's a purely digital conception. Winners One is the, whatever we're up to, fourth one. This is really interesting and another thing that's challenging for old school designers like me. Because what Microsoft is trying to tell us here is leverage the platform and the rules in the platform so that we're all consistent and so that all our applications stand together as one to introduce our users to the new paradigms. And so the classic example is you're just so tempted to put a button on the screen because you know as a user interface designer that this is a place where we really needed a button close to the content. And the rules say we're not allowed to do that. And for my app, I'm tempted to say, well, bugger all the other applications. This is going to make my app more awesome. What Microsoft wants us to do is to take one for the team. They want us to use the consistent search UI. They want us to use the consistent search stuff. They want us to not put buttons inside our screens. They want us to use the rules as written for how to place buttons in the app bar. They want us to comply with the grid and the font ramp and all that sort of stuff so that the platform as a whole appears coherent and consistent. And that you're particularly using the share charm. The idea is that we connect ourselves with the other applications on our user's platform to create something that's, you know, a sum that's greater than the whole. Do more than less with less is more about, well, it comes back to what, it's sort of related to what we were saying about pride in craftsmanship. Particularly with where we're talking about mobile scenarios like tablets and phones, what we expect people to do is snack on our applications, to dip in, do something quite specific, probably in a relatively limited amount of time, and leave again and possibly return to that activity later. What we know from all the mobile platforms is the best apps are the ones that have a single clear proposition and do that well. So whatever smartphone you guys are carrying, when you think about the apps that you like the most, chances are they do one thing really well. And Microsoft is encouraging us to do the same thing. To focus on a specific set of functionality, deliver that really well, and then leverage things like search and share to maybe enhance our application by interacting with other applications. So a sort of a personal side note and why I've been enjoying designing for the new user interfaces. Who was that? Someone up here? Oh, yeah, right at the back. Good on you. Is I'm a bit of a rationalist as a designer. I didn't study design at school. I studied psychology. And all of my UI design is inspired by what I know about how people think and process information and perform tasks and learn skills. So I derive pretty much all my UI design with this rationalist approach. So this stuff makes sense to me as a designer. And hopefully, particularly for those of you who aren't as confident or as experienced in design, you can take heart from that. The other thing that I'm really enjoying about designing for the new platform is the use of animation. Because I've never been a motion designer, and now I'm trying to teach myself to be a motion designer. It's not easy. Getting the right animation, the right transition, having that jigger just slow down and stop exactly right, knowing when you've done too much or not enough in terms of your motion design, is not something that comes natural to me, and I've been trying to learn off the web. There's not a lot to learn from there. There's one particular book that was written back in the 50s by some of the original Disney animators that have some interesting advice. There's some stuff to learn from motion design for broadcast, particularly infographics on TV. But it is an entirely new domain that I'm learning to design for. And what's really interesting, you can't wireframe animations. And we have this tendency to design user interfaces as a series of static screens and worry less about the transitions between them. And we figure if we've designed each of these individual static screens or pages well, then we've designed a good user interface. But it's as much as anything, it's about the journey and the flow between those states as it is about the individual screens. And as I've said at TechEd before, that's where you can get yourself into trouble. You can design a series of awesome screens and a horrible information architecture or a horrible navigation paradigm that can ruin all your good work. And what's worse is if you get that wrong, that's much more expensive to fix if you find that late in your project. So I'm having a lot of fun trying to get my head around the idea of motion design. Maybe by this time next year I'll have enough content that maybe I could, if you'll have me back, I'll come back and do an hour about animation and motion design and transitions. But from my point of view, that's why I've been enjoying working on this platform. So I right at the start, I kind of hinted at this idea that it's more than just pixels on the screen. That, we're talking about a particular visual language, a particular vocabulary, fonts, logos, spacing, grids, gaps, app bars, icons, all that sort of stuff that is the vocabulary and that we'll talk about more tomorrow. But as much as anything, the new user interfaces ask us to think about a different or a new approach to navigation and information design, as well as a different approach to interaction and how we communicate to people how you can and should interact with our stuff. And yes, I think there is an attitude to this stuff. I'm not sure that I want to put it in words, but I think these apps have a particular sort of personality about them. And maybe it comes from that authentically digital, that sort of stripped back, it's all about the content. But there's a particular attitude, I think, that sort of makes a Metro app feel like one of those apps. So I've said this to you guys before, don't start by designing your visuals. In fact, I think I say that in a great big slide. A great experience starts long before your visual design. So when we talk about user experience design, I like to talk about four types, categories of design, or four phases even. The conceptual design, the information design, the interaction design, and the visual. The conceptual design is what is the premise of our application? What are we trying to achieve, and what will make our application successful? What's the type of experience and response we're trying to create? It's only once you know that that you can drill down and say, right, how shall I structure that information and the content? How shall I distribute that across screens and pop-ups and flyouts? How will I allow people to interact with that information and that functionality? And finally, how will I communicate all of that with visuals? So today we've been talking about sort of the premise behind the design language and how you should apply that to derive the premise of your app. Tomorrow we'll dive in and talk a little bit more about the rules. So I've said all that. There is some guidance up on MSDN for exactly this sort of stuff, how to derive the concept behind your application. So you know, relative to all the rules and regulations about fonts and colors, this is a relatively small bit of information, but it's very useful to you guys when you start to plan a new application. Here's the seven steps that are the seven steps that Microsoft recommends us for planning a Windows 8 user experience. And that first one is deciding what your goals are, what you're trying to achieve, and that's mostly what we've been talking about today. Tomorrow we're going to sort of skip through quickly through 2, 3, 4 and so I need to skip that slide just for time's sake. We're going to talk about the actual layout tomorrow. But I just wanted to pull out this idea of the best app statement. Microsoft says that the first thing we should do is complete this sentence. My app or our app will be the best app for something. So this comes back to being really good at something quite specific. And always returning to that best app statement as you go about designing your app. I think that's really good advice. To do that, you need to understand who it is you're designing for. So for the phone, Microsoft actually invented these two personas, Miles and Anna. And there, when they designed the overall platform user interface, they had these two people in mind. And if you've come to my talks before, I've talked about this idea of creating personas, creating a small number of people that you think encapsulate the type of people and the type of motivations that those people will have for your users. So that's something to think about as well. And I don't want to use all my time, so I'm going to fast forward a little bit. As I said, tomorrow we'll talk about planning the actual layout of your app. I want to talk really briefly about branding and then I'm done. Because this is something that people worry about with this new UI. Because it's so sparse, because because there's only one font and it only comes in three sizes, because there's such specific layouts, because there's no 3D-ness, how am I going to express my brand? And I've had this conversation with a lot of my customers. Oh, I don't know how we feel about these new user interfaces because there's just no opportunity to express the intrinsic nature of my brand. The first thing to say, I guess, is that actually when you think about it, it's surprisingly just how versatile the design language can be. You can combine these elements in a lot of different ways, and particularly by introducing the use of photography, to express a whole lot of different attitudes and also to just to have a unique identity. So while, you know, I'm nervous that a lot of, you know, apps, particularly for the phone, all look identical, with a little bit of thought, it is possible to use the vocabulary you've been given to express a particular identity. But I think more important than that, you need to think beyond your logo. You need to think beyond your colors, your fonts, and your logos. Sure, if you've got brand imagery, if you've got a logo, if you've got corporate colors, then that's a starting place for your design. But the key point here is that your brand is a conversation between you and your customers. Old school marketing people get obsessive about the proper use of their logo and their corporate colors and their corporate font, because in old school marketing, pretty much all your relationship with your customer was all read-only. It was on bus ads and TV ads and on the bill that you received in the mail. But now when we interact with the companies that we use for their services and products, well, it's much more interactive, because these companies, like NAB, since we're looking at it, are expressing their services and functions through these digital products. So the relationship I build with my bank or my airline or my pizza provider is not just about, oh yes, I remember that logo or those colors or that font. It's about that conversation, that journey we've been on together. And this is kind of how I get my clients to relax a little bit about the branding, is to say, the great opportunity of these interactive, immediately available, you know, in your pocket apps is that your brand can be expressed through that amazing service rather than just through your colors and fonts. And so the NAB app and the Qantas app are both a couple of examples of our apps. The Qantas design, we worked in conjunction with the in-house designers of Qantas. I think both do an interesting job, feel free to tell me later if you don't agree, of getting the purpose across, and by doing that, we just need relatively few brand elements to still have a well-branded application. And that those brand opportunities come across that whole journey. I won't read out all those bullet points for you, but there's a whole bunch of touch points, not just inside your app even, that create that branded experience for you. I just wanted to tag that branding stuff onto the end, because as I said, a lot of people when they first see this stuff think, oh, it's not going to be good for my logo. So the summary slide goes something like this. If we can think about these new design languages as one possible future direction for user interface design. And it comes from this sort of asking ourselves, well, what's next? And thinking about those digital natives, thinking about the idea that they don't need all those references to the real world. The Swiss Design School folk told us that information is beautiful, and that if we express the information well, we've done the bulk of the job. The only catch there is that our information now has to work harder. We have to get the visual hierarchy right. We'll talk about that tomorrow, so that people understand the relationship between the information. The information itself has to communicate the brand, and that the content itself is the user interface, that rather than having elements next to the content that tell you what to do and how to do it, the content itself has to be what we manipulate. We call it direct manipulation, to achieve the goals we want. So we drag the content, we stretch the content, we tap the content, whatever we do, that is now the user interface. We talked about the power of animation as a tool for orientation, for helping people to understand where they are in the app and where what they can do. And we talked about authentically digital and the idea that maybe we don't need to, or at least we have the option to not decorate our screens with references to the real world, maybe we can be confident enough to be purely digital. I said brand is a conversation, not a logo, and I think that's the last point. So thanks everyone for your attention. If you like what you heard, come back tomorrow morning at 8. There's way too many related content items for me to sort of fit on one slide. But what's new for Windows 8 developers, part one was just before, but there's two more parts to go. There's a bunch of different phone sessions to have a look at. I'll be around in the speaker's lounge after this, and we've got just a few minutes for questions. Thanks very much. Questions?
How do you see the fear of change? So Windows 8 is very different for the user. How do you see that fear of that change in managing that user experience?
So the question is, you know, should we be worried about fear of change? Well, people, I guess, when people see the new user interface, it's quite different to what they've seen before. Are they going to be frightened? I think that's true. I think it's Microsoft's job to do a whole bunch of marketing. I think that it's our job to create apps that people can feel safe using. Between those two things, we've got some work to do. But I don't think Metro in it of itself, when you first see it. Who was that? I don't think it in and of itself is going to achieve that. We've got some work to do. Any other questions?
Just specifically something new. When you look at a Metro tile right now, you can't do information in that Metro tile that you didn't used to be able to do. Let's talk about something like business information that you could dynamically put into that. Is that something we should be heading towards, do you think, in using tiles similar to that?
Sure. So the question was about, you know, we've got this opportunity to expose information in our tiles. What should we be doing with it? I mean, I think the purpose of the tile is to provoke action. It's to signal to our users, hey, we've got something new that may be interesting to you or that you need to see. I think you've got to be genuine about it. If you start being frivolous just to attract attention, people will, and I've seen them do it, will shut your tile down to the small tile to lose those animations. The short answer I say is think about it as like a shop window. If your app is a shop and someone's walking down the street, which is that start screen, what do you need to put in their window, in your window, to remind them to come in and visit? And just don't overdo it. That would be my answer to tiles. Maybe take one more question. Yep. Awesome question. So, you know, the question is, what have they got to offer us for content creation, for line of business applications where you're filling in forms or typing in information, stuff like that? Two-part answer. There is a bunch of guidance on MSDN about this. In fact, the topic, I printed out the topic for form filling applications last week. It's 29 pages. I haven't read it. I've been carrying it around in my bag for about a week. So Microsoft acknowledges that you will have some apps that are much more about content creation. Glancing through that topic, and one of the other apps we've been working on, this has been a challenge for us as well. What's interesting is that it's not so much of a departure from what you know. Text boxes, forms, labels, validation, at least what Microsoft is telling us is pretty much what you would have done on a WinForms or a desktop app. Just with Metro styling. But my caveat to that is be sure that you want to create one of those apps and not a plain old desktop app. I mean, there's advantages of both, but as I was saying before, it's the desktop GUI that gives us all the rich controls and conventions that allow us to do that productivity work. Who would like to claim that one? We'll take one more, and since you've had a go, yeah.
Thank you. At the Windows 8, you have a lot of tiles to in the front screen. When you're going to your application, it's going to have a lot more tiles because you present your content either as an app of inline or a content base. Now, if it's like an app like for mine, like a financial app, then you have a lot of information in there, but what they recommend is more blend. Do I then, like, you know, as I say, imagery as a graphic person to a blend, you know, plain solid color, do you mix them together or do you blend them together or you just pick one or the other?
Well, that's a long question. So maybe you've got an application that has, like a financial application that has a lot of sort of just information. How are you going to sort of get that sort of panorama effect on the front page? Firstly, I guess it's worth saying you don't have to have a panorama. But the better answer is think about the nature of the content. Think about what users might want to see when they arrive. Microsoft provides some really good guidance for the phone when they say, think of your panorama like a magazine cover, which is kind of similar to analogy to the shop window, I guess. If someone is returning to this to your app, what would be the at-a-glance stuff you'd want them to see? It could be the work, what you were doing last time, you know, so you could return to your work. It could be some sort of dashboard business intelligence type stuff. Have a look at the finance app, the Bing finance app. It does have some imagery, but it looks quite good just because they've got well-presented graphs and charts and tables of information. You know, coming back to that Swiss design thing, if you structure that information in a way that makes it easy for people to process and valuable, that's as aesthetically pleasing as a beautiful photograph. So certainly don't feel that you have to, you know, create things that are visually beautiful, as long as that they're structured in a way that seems professional and satisfying. Sort of a wishy-washy answer, sorry. I'll hang out at the front, but I think we probably should let you guys go. And then I make my way to the speaker's lounge when I get a chance. Thanks, everyone. Sweet.